When Julia Ward Howe originally penned that Mother's Day proclamation in 1870, the Franco-Prussian War had just ended, a war in which machine guns had turned battlefields into mechanized slaughterhouses. She described in her reminiscences how the question came into her mind, why do not the mothers of humankind interfere in these matters to prevent the waste of human life of which they alone know and bear the cost? In this proclamation, she asked for an international congress to be convened with women of all continents to bridge international differences, to bring about mechanisms for conflict resolution. The Mother's Day Peace Festival that she proposed was the forerunner of this holiday we celebrate today. She would have been disappointed to realize that Mother's Day has lost sight to a large degree of its original purpose, and it may have been just as well that she didn't live to see the First World War, for until the very end of her life in 1910, she continued to be hopeful, optimistic, that a better, more civilized era might be dawning. Still, I think she would have been gratified to learn that we do set aside at least one day each year to honor mothers and women's contributions to the world, and it's appropriate to honor Howe herself. She was a forerunner of the modern feminist movement, and in her struggles to break out of the constraints that burdened Victorian women, she helped to liberate others to live fully beyond the roles of wife and mother. The groundwork for her later accomplishments as an author and writer and reformer and organizer were laid down early. She was the daughter of Samuel Ward, who never had the benefits of a college education but managed to become one of the richest private bankers in New York, and he was determined to give his children the education that he never had. Julia remembered learning to speak and read French in the nursery. Literature and the Bible were also part of her curriculum, and she would later be introduced to Italian and German, as well as to training in voice and piano, where she excelled. When she was growing up, she sometimes made her sister physically tie her to her desk, so she could not leave her studies. She was stealing herself to a regime of hard work and self-discipline. And yet, her education at establishments like Miss Catherine Roberts School for Young Ladies, where Julia learned to memorize long passages of ponderous moral theology, that education was not really intended to light the fires of the mind or to stimulate independent thinking. The goal, rather, was to prepare pupils like her for their destined domestic roles. When Julia published her first serious work, a translation of a now-forgotten poem, her uncle John expressed the mixture of a pride and bewilderment within her family with the comment, "This is my little girl who knows about books and can write an article and have it published, but I wish she knew more about housekeeping." Religion was an important part of Julia's upbringing. Her mother was from stern Scotch Presbyterian background. It was her rather strict religiosity, rather than her father's more easygoing low church Episcopalianism, that colored her imagination. The woman who later wrote the stanzas to the battle hymn would never entirely lose her belief in a righteous Old Testament God. The Bible always remained for her a touchstone, with good and evil locked on the battlefield of earth as in the human heart. In one chance encounter, Julia found herself riding a train into Boston, seated next to the arch heretic Ralph Waldo Emerson. "I do not wish to meet this wicked man," she told her traveling companion. Then, attempting to impress Emerson with the correctness of her religious views, Julia spoke at length on the power of Satan in the world and the depth of sin in the human heart. Listening patiently, Emerson finally responded, "Surely the angel must be stronger than the demon." Julia found what she called a gentle, ethereal quality in the great man, which belied his reputed wickedness, and the two became fast friends, and Julia eventually joined the Unitarian Church. What remained of her childhood religion was a determination to be of service to others, like her father, a founder of New York University, and like her grandmama, Isabella Graham, who founded the Society for the Relief of Poor Widows and Small Children, which was one of the first charitable establishments in the United States. Julia always believed that religion should be about helping other people. And it may have been those charitable instincts that first drew her to the figure of Samuel Gridley Howe. Howe had acquired a name for himself when he traveled to Greece to be part of the uprising there, joining the revolutionaries to throw off Turkish rule, fighting, using his medical training on the battlefield, which along with his valor earned him the title of Chevalier of the Greek Legion of Honor. And when he returned to this country, the Chevalier was always known by his nickname, Chev. Returning to this country, Chev found a new outlet for his vigor and idealism. He became the director of what was called the New England Asylum for the Blind, the Perkins Institute, as it's better known, which was the perfect place for a man like Howe. All through his life, he tried to be at the forefront of activities for social betterment. He was also a good-looking man, black hair, blue eyes, soldierly, commanding bearing. He proved fatefully attractive to Julia, and the two were engaged in the spring of 1843, resulting in a stormy courtship. While his politics were progressive, his views of marriage were conservative in the extreme. And from the outset, he made it clear to Julia that he would expect her to set aside her literary ambitions to become a full-time wife and mother. Although he did admire independent women like Dorothea Dix, with whom he worked side by side for prison reform and more humane treatment of the mentally ill, Chev was adamant that married women had no place in public life. He was also ambivalent about Julia's wealth, which made her financially independent of her husband. He demanded at first that Julia give up her fortune before they married, and when her family refused to allow that, he demanded that control over the inheritance be turned over to him. The family, again, wisely refused, and at last a compromise was negotiated. The poet, a Longfellow, a friend of the young couple, sensed trouble ahead. He described Julia as a fine young buxom damsel of force and beauty, who's full of talent, indeed carrying almost too many guns for any man who doesn't want to be firing salutes all the time. After some hesitation about becoming the submissive spouse of Samuel Howe, Julia finally set aside her doubts and wrote to her brother that his true devotion has won me from the world and from myself. I am the captive of his bow and spear. But as one final gesture of independence, the bride did retain her maiden name. She would never be Mrs. Samuel Gridley Howe, but always Mrs. Julia Ward Howe. The marriage was not a happy one. At the request of Horace Mann, Shav joined the Boston School Committee and threw himself into an endless round of meetings, leaving him little time for his new wife. Julia, whose family was in New York, found herself in a strange city, homesick for familiar faces. And she was soon pregnant, whether because her own mother had died of childbirth fever delivering her eighth infant, or because she was simply in a family way, Julia was naturally anxious and upset, a condition that her husband found hard to fathom. In typical male fashion, Shev idealized the mother-child bond, comparing Julia to one of Raphael's Madonnas, enthusing at the birth of their first child. To see her watching with eager, anxious eyes every movement of her offspring, to witness her entire self-forgetfulness and the total absorption of her nature in this new object of love, is a fresh revelation of the beauty and strength of women's character, new proof of their superiority, even in what most ennobles humankind, the love of others. Meanwhile, in those first years of marriage, Julia would confide to a notebook, "I live in a place where I have few social relations, all of them too recent to be intimate. I've no family around me. My babies are all infants. My husband has scarcely half an hour in 24 to give to me. So as I think much in my way, and nobody takes the least interest in what I think, I'm forced to make myself an imaginary public and tell it the secrets of my poor, ridiculous little brain." In her private poetry, she poured out her misery, blaming herself for her own unhappiness with her womanly lot. "Hope died as I was led unto my marriage bed. Nay, do not weep, 'twas I, not thou, that slew my happiest destiny. When once I know my sphere, life shall no more be drear. I will be all thou wilt, and to cross thy least desire shall be guilt." One person who encouraged Julia to rise above this wifely penitence and resignation was Reverend Theodore Parker, the radical Unitarian minister whose views on sexual equality shocked many of his contemporaries. To make half the human race consume its energies in the functions of housekeeper, wife, and mother is a monstrous waste of the most precious material God ever made, Parker said. And he encouraged Julia to put her talents to use, speaking in public, preaching in church. Julia became a dedicated worshiper at the old Melodeon Theater, where Parker held forth each Sunday, until her husband objected, believing that the children needed a more respectable spiritual home. Reluctantly, again, Julia obeyed. She transferred her membership to James Freeman Clark's Church of the Disciples, another Unitarian parish, but not before a seed of rebellion had been planted. In 1853, she took a book of her poems to the Boston publisher Ticknor, Reed, and Fields, who agreed to release them under the title Passion Flowers. The poems appeared anonymously. Her husband, Chev, was to know nothing about this. Authorship was to remain secret. But the book was an unmitigated success. And soon all of Boston knew not only that Anonymous was a woman, but that she was also, in fact, the wife of Samuel Gridley Howe. Chev was irate, although slightly mollified by the considerable profits the book was bringing. He was especially angered, however, by one particular poem titled Mind Versus Mill Stream. It tells how a miller tries to build a wheel to harness the power of a rushing brook, but each time the channel runs too fast and sweeps away his efforts, the poem ends with a moral. If you would marry happily on the shady side of life, choose out some quietly disposed and placid-tempered wife to share the length of sober days and dimly slumberous nights. But well beware those fitful souls, fate wings for wilder flights, for men will woo the tempest and wed it to their cost, then swear they took it for summer dew, and ah, their peace is lost. This was a taunt to Chev's masculine pride to suggest that he could not control his spouse. And the next few months were the worst in Julia's life as her marriage threatened to end in separation. Chev is as cold and indifferent to me as a man can well be, she wrote to her sister Annie. I sometimes suspect him of having relations with another woman, a suspicion that would be borne out at the end of Chev's life when he confessed to his infidelity. And yet, Chev and Julia's relationship, however difficult, however flawed, was not without its warm, tender moments. When he passed away, Julia would be grieved to think that in place of my dear husband, I have now my foolish papers, and yet how often I've left him for them. The great crusade of that time, of course, was abolition. Chev was a part of the plot to arm John Brown, one of Boston's secret six, funding the ill-fated uprising at Harper's Ferry. And Julia was also active in the anti-slavery movement. And it was not long before the advocates of freedom for the black man began to ask the question, why not women's equality also? When it was declared that all men were born free and equal, Julia reasoned, it was certainly implied that all women were so born. In 1869, she was elected the president of the New England Women Suffrage Association, and for the remainder of her life, she continued to lecture and agitate on behalf of women's rights, not as a radical, unlike Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was head of the rival National Woman Suffrage Association. Julia did not envision any fundamental reordering of society, unlike Stanton. She did not come out in support of abortion or birth control. For Julia and the other moderates, like Lucy Stone and Mary Livermore, the right to vote was the real prize, and they felt that it would delay suffrage to entangle it with other causes. the enfranchisement of women, so they believed and hoped, would be enough in itself to usher in a whole new age of advancement, peace, and cooperation. Fortunately, Julia was in high demand as a speaker. Her husband, who after years did manage to gain proprietorship over her inheritance, promptly lost the entire fortune. And after his death, Julia had to worry about money as never before. She had been paid only $4 for the lyrics to the battle hymn, but the song made her nationally famous, and her voice and stage presence guaranteed her popularity on the rostrum, where she spoke not only about women's rights, but about manners, morals, literature, and religion. What is the ideal aim of life? She asked in one of her speeches, to learn, to teach, to serve, to enjoy. Her own life epitomized those ideals, her dream of one world at peace seems to us as far away, as distant as ever it has been. But in her time, abolition was also a distant dream. Many believed that votes for women would never come to pass. Julia refused to live by the limits of what others decreed to be possible or impossible, and by believing in a better, more hopeful world than the one she found herself in, she helped bring that new world into being. In her old age, she was something of a national institution, the first woman elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Some compared her to a Victoria, inspiring from the American people the same kind of spontaneous love and goodwill that the British had for their queen. Yet her course of early morning travels and cross-country trips did take a toll on the aging matriarch. Her latter years were spent quietly at home, reading philosophy, writing, surrounded by the family and friends of a long lifetime. In 1907, she wrote, "Yes, I've had a lot of birthdays, and I'm growing very old. That's why they make so much of me, if once the truth were told. And I love the shade in summer, and in winter love the sun. And I'm just learning how to live. My wisdom's just begun."